Each time you trill a song with Bill or look at Will, I get a chill. I'm gloomy. I won't recall the names of all the men who fall. It's all appalling to me. Of course, I really cannot blame them a bit, for you're a hit where'er you flit. I know it's so, but dearie, oh, you'll never know the blues that go right through me. I've got the you don't know the half of it, Jerry blues. The trouble is you have so many from whom to choose. If you should marry Tom, Dick, or Harry, life would be the bunk. I'd become a monk. I've got the you don't know the half of it, Jerry blues.
You were hurt each time I'd flirt with Bill or Bert. You brute, you. Well, I'm repaid. I felt betrayed when any maid whom you surveyed would suit you. Compared to you, I've been as good as could be. Yet here you are, lecturing me. You're just a guy who makes me cry. Yet though I try to cut you, I salute you. I've got the you don't know the half of it, dearie blues. Oh, how I wish you'd drop an anchor and end your cruise. You're just a duffer who makes me suffer. All the younger set says your heart's to let. I've got the you don't know the half of it, dearie blues. Permission, it's my ambition just to go through life saying meet the wife.
I've got the you don't know the half of it, dearie blues.
From the album These Charming People, that was The Half of It, Dearie Blues, we heard Joan Morris along with Max Morath doing the vocals on that, with William Balcom at the piano. Joan Morris and Bill Balcom are in the studio with me now. I'd like to ask each of you to describe each other's work and what each other's work does for you.
When I first met Bill, he was working on an orchestration for Treemonisha, and whenever I saw him perform, it was mostly, you know, ragtime things. I'm trying to think of the first piece of his. Well, I heard Graceful Ghost, which was a rag, which I just loved. And then shortly after that, after we met, there was one of those prospective encounters where Pierre Boulez, you know, conducted modern music, and then they'd have a encounter afterwards. You know, people would talk about, ask questions and all this.
Mm-hmm. All the same questions.
Yeah, well,
why didn't you write something with a tone in it?
What's your inspiration? Yeah.
Did your mother want you to be a musician?
So on.
Yeah. And that was, it was Morning and Evening Poems that they did. It was Phyllis Brynjolfsson sang it. That I didn't care for. I thought it was, well, you know, that's that modern music. I mean, you don't expect to understand it. You just kind of, you know, look at your watch surreptitiously and wait for it to get over, you know. But let's see, oh, and then after that, he was also working, besides the Treemonisha thing, on a string quartet. And that, the first time we heard it, they had only prepared the last three movements, and I just loved it. I thought it was wonderful. The last movement is really exuberant and all this stuff. And then when I heard the whole thing, the first part I didn't quite understand, but I've gotten to like that a lot. I see where it's all fitting together and going and all this. And since then, most of the things that Bill's written, I like. You know, there's sections that I don't understand, and there's there's parts that I like a lot. The newest piece I really like, start to finish, the violin sonata. I don't know. I can't give an opinion on him. Musically, that's about all I know. I like something, you know. I don't know how to analyze it or, you know, tell you why it's terrific or this. And I know, what's that old thing? I may not know what I like, but I know what... I know what's good or something like that.
No.
What, how does that thing go?
Oh, that was that thing in Dynamite Tonight where the two characters are talking and one of them, the sergeant turns to the captain and says, "You know, Captain, you can sing." They've just been singing this song. And the sergeant says, "Oh, really? You think so?" And he says, "Well, yes, I do know a lot about music. I may not know what I like, but I do know a lot about music."
That's it, yeah.
Well, Bill Balcom, I guess it's your turn to describe... how you feel about Joan Morris' singing?
Well, when I first heard one of Joni's pieces, her symphony in Q flat, I was particularly unimpressed.
What? It's all over between us. I'm leaving. Give me my egg sandwich. Goodbye.
Actually, I think what you probably really wanted to hear, Terry, is what she thought of my piano playing, and so it's all right, but it's very nice.
Yeah, that's true, really.
That's probably what you really wanted to hear. Yeah. So do you want to recycle?
Well, when he practices, it's
not, that's about the truth.
Oh, no, that's, what can I say, you know, that's, I like it.
Well, I think we work together very well, and what Joni does as a singer is what I always wanted some singer to be able to do, which is really convey what the words and music do, and without trying to impose a style on it. I don't think that Joni's ever sat down and tried to, you know, patent her own tricks, you know, and I think there are singers who do that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you don't have to. I mean, you know, the minute you hear that it's Joni, you don't have to, you know, there's no characteristic little tricksy thing that says, okay, here I am. There's no hook that she uses. It's just her own particular voice. And you hear all the words. And the lines that are articulated are articulated. You can hear everything. It's all there. It's just what I've always wanted a singer to be. And so that's what she does. I don't know. This is hard to describe these things.
Yeah.
We've been working together so many years, you know. It's hard to... I couldn't sit down and tell you exactly. But it's just that she embodies what I've always wanted other singers to be able to do. And then now she does it. And if I could write a stage work or an opera... with all the singers that had that same kind of smarts, I would be the happiest man alive. Instead of the usual people who sing, "You don't know the half of it, dearie blues." You know.
people who make something sung in English sound like it's really being sung in Italian or German.
Well, right. You know, it's like Luciano Berio once put it. He says, you know, "I can't stand this thing American singers do. This is they sing English in British Italian," which is perfect.
That's about it. They Italianize the vowels. I was taught to do that, too. When I first started singing, you know, ah and ooh, you know, you would go to the pure vowel sound instead of saying the word because it was a prettier tone. Which I don't think you need to sacrifice tone to get. I mean, you need to sacrifice the words to get a beautiful tone.
Well, yeah. Is there a push for people doing the kinds of work you're doing now to make it sound arty? Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, not so much anymore. I think we've had some influence on people. I think
that's for sure.
Yeah, I think that what's happened, well, I'm glad to hear it, because I've noticed that, I think the biggest problem a lot of singers have found was to be able to find a style in which you could sing English, which would be a viable style. But the basic first principle of it is that there aren't pure vowels, there are diphthongs. And you don't have to punch every consonant until you end up getting your microphone all wet. There's just you just don't have to. But at the same time, what you have to do is emphasize certain words, and you pull back on other words. And you know, there's a kind of a hill and dale effect, which is how English, and especially American, is spoken. So if you do that when you sing it, well, then people will understand.
We're going to hear a recording of Till the Clouds Roll By. I think it's a really beautiful song, which I wasn't very familiar with before your album came out. Mm-hmm. I'd heard it in passing, but didn't know it well. And I went back to try to find the soundtrack recording of it, which is in all of the out-of-print bins for, like, you know, $1.99
right,
or something.
Uh-huh.
It's this big production number with, you know, large choruses singing, chirping
well,
it.
But you know why, of course, is because Till the Clouds Roll By became one of those songs that helped... the English and the Americans get through the First World War. It was sort of one of those themes that, you know, in the middle of all the bombs, you sort of thought of, you know, the rain goes a pitter-patter, boom, and another bomb falls next to your house. And it was a sort of a cheer-up, feel-better type of song for a lot of people. They didn't worry too much about the plot. Mm-hmm. But, of course, that doesn't matter, you know, so much to us. But
I don't know how it was done in the original show. I think it mentions it on the album, how it was done. But sometimes they turn, especially in the 30s, in the big musicals, they turn numbers that weren't meant to be into big production things. It was also the title, Till the Clouds Were By, of the movie biography of Kern.
Oh,
which starred... Who's played Robert Walker?
It could have been Robert. I forget too. I think I've seen that movie.
Robert Walker also played Brahms, so yeah. I guess.
Generally, those things are on like about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I can't remember anything that I've seen at 2 o'clock in the morning. So.
Okay, well, we're going to hear that recording of "Till the Clouds Roll By" now. Is there anything else you'd like to say about your recording of it before we hear it?
Both our mommies love the song.
Oh, I do too. Yeah.
it's a beautiful,
of that album,
beautiful
this is the one
tune.
That I've played over and over again.
Yeah, it really, it's one of the most beautiful tunes ever written. It really is.
Let's hear it.
I'm so sad to think that I have had to drive you from your home so coolly.
I'll be gaining nothing by remaining. What would Mrs. Grundy say? Her conventions, kindly recollect them. We must please respect them duly.
My intrusion needs explaining. I felt my courage waning.
Please, I beg, don't mention it. I should not mind a bit, but it has started raining.
Comes a pitter-patter, and I'd like to be safe in bed. Skies are weeping while the world is sleeping, trouble heaping on. It's coming down in buckets. Have you an umbrella handy?
I've a warm coat, waterproof, a storm coat. I shall be all right, I know. Later on, too, I will ward the grip off with a little nip of brandy.
Or a glass of toddy draining. You'd find that more sustaining.
Don't be worried, I entreat. I've rubbers for my feet, so I don't mind it raining. Oh, the rain comes a pitter-patter, and I'd like to be safe in bed.
Skies are weeping. Keeping on our head. It is vain to remain and chatter and to wait for a clearer sky.
sure people applaud your efforts at going back to America's finest composers like Jerome Kern and finding some of the songs that the American public may have forgotten about. Suddenly, though, you went back and found the songs of Lieber and Stoller.
Well, they're also among America's finest composers. It's very funny that you should use that particular phrase. Last night we had dinner with George Rochberg, who's an old pal of mine, and we've known each other for many years. And George was saying, well, you know, after all our hard work, and we're both serious hard-working composers and all the rest, and people are playing us, and then right now he's getting a very nice success, which he's long deserved, I'm getting nice commissions and, you know, all the rest of it. And we're both doing quite well, so we sort of get together and meet every so often. You know, after all this hard work and soul-searching and nonsense, I'll bet you, what will people remember from the 20th century from American composers? And we mentioned Jerome Kern, George Gershwin, Irving Berlin. You know, these are things that are closer to our consciousness than anybody wants to realize. And, you know, there's all this wonderful serious effort to be great composers, a la Beethoven, but these people are... I think something about popular music, it accrues meaning after it's been written. Arnold Weinstein always talks about the indestructibility of the great American popular music. It just does not wear out. It adds.
Well, I mean, the Schubert songs were not written originally to be great Lieder. They were just written as songs that he did amongst a circle of friends, and, you know, they were little acting pieces.
Oh, there were serious works out of that. There were things that were meant to be that, but there were also sort of, you know, Schlager things. There were things that were meant to be hit. There were things that immediately got into the folk song albums. Well, they happened to be written by Schubert, you know. So it's a very more unified point of view about what music should be. In other words, there are things that are direct. There are things that are more obscure. And you're talking about Lieber and Stoller. Now, here's a couple of guys who have won it on both sides of the fence, too. And their problem, critically, has been, why are they doing all this stuff? Why don't they continue with the old 1950s rock and roll? Because they can't. They're older now. They have more experience behind them, and they don't need to.
And that's what prevents them from being on the nostalgia rock and roll circuit, you know, where they bring back the old groups who do the old songs. I mean, that's a lot of fun, but you wouldn't want to prevent someone from growing and insist that they do what they did in the 1950s.
Exactly, and when we go back now and do the 90s songs, they've grown and there's so many more dimensions to them than there were if we had just stuck with doing only those. But having done the Lieber and Stoller and the ways I had to stretch myself to do some of those, now when I go back and do the 90s, I'm much freer dramatically. And
you think there's a certain period of time that a song has to sit or be around before you can really get a sense of whether it's going to be a song that can endure?
I don't think so.
I have no idea about endurance. I have no idea about how things will last. And I don't necessarily... I'm not even absolutely certain that a thing that has a long endurance is necessarily a better piece of work. There are certain things which are so much of their time, they make a perfect kind of sense in their time, and so they go a very short time after that. It's like saying Beaujolais wine is not as good as a very wonderful old Burgundy wine, because you can't drink the Burgundy for 10 years, and the Beaujolais you better drink the first 2 years or it's no good. Well, you need both. Mm-hmm. We have to have wine you have to drink this week, and you have to have wine that can wait for 10 years. And I like both, really. I don't think that I can necessarily say that the one is a greater experience. I mean, the one is a different kind. There are certain things. It's like a good egg sandwich has got to be eaten in the next hour.
Some things, like On the Banks of the Wabash, that's a wonderful song. That took off right away. It was a big hit from the beginning. But another one of his, My Gal Sal, which is just as great a song, got nowhere for the first couple. What killed him. He didn't have. He needed a hit. He needed money. And it just didn't get going. And
after he died.
Died of a broken heart.
Yep.
Are there tunes on the radio now that you would really like to be singing? You know, and tunes that we would just associate with their context on the FM or on the AM. You know.
Oh, you mean things by the
current groups?
I always sing along with. I mean, I love the Bee Gees stuff. I love the Saturday Night Fever score, and I like. I don't like everything Linda Ronstadt does, but some songs, the combination of her voice on a particular tune is just like Blue Bayou. Ooh, I love that. I love listening to that. And let's see other.
And even
people.
Some things by Billy Joel. You know, there's some talented writers around now, and it's just like always. It's a question of. If the balance between the words and the music is good, a lot of music for a while, and there was, I mean, a lot of tunes were very word-oriented. There was a long time in there where the tune was sort of throwaway. Well, there's nothing much you can do with that, because the person who wrote the words is a very personal thing. Mm-hmm. And to take a James Taylor tune, for example, and you also do that James Taylor tune, you really can't add anything to it. There's nothing more you can do. It's perfectly
right.
marvelous when he does it, mm-hmm. but I don't see what we can do with it.
That's
so
right. That's it about doing those songs. You know, if there's someone around that's doing them in not a definitive version, but you know what I mean, where they're really done well, like I love a lot of Bob Dylan's. We have done some of the Beatles things, but the Bob Dylan songs, to me, what he does, a combination of his voice and the feeling on them, just like what Paul McCartney does, mm-hmm. I mean, there's no need for an interpreter, whereas a lot of the 30 songs, people are camping them up, like, remember that album that Harry Nilsson did, which was, you know, very interesting.
It
but
wasn't
I
campy.
Felt
he did it out of love,
were,
but it was
right.
It was lugubrious.
There was too much love. It was just like all the syrup poured on it, and he lost, you know, some of the essential, the beat, the heartbeat, which keeps it going. And you can't be reverent to the point of you know, not playing around with it, not making it live for yourself, just thinking of it as an entity that you've got to respect and not, you know, kick around a little bit.
You know, one of the things that has, of course, been a problem, I think, for writers, and that is that you are asked to produce at least 12 good songs per year if you've got a year contract and an album. Now, in the singles days, which was most of the time for most of these people, it was either you put together a show, that's something else, then you have to write 24 or 28 songs, out of which maybe you'll say 15 or 20. That's normal. That's a different situation. But if you're putting together what's supposed to be an album, a very well-balanced album, you have to keep writing and so on and so forth, then you end up with an awful lot of songs, which are very often very nice in an album context, but will not work as singles. Now, in the days of Lieber and Stoller, their big market was singles. But it's very hard to extract singles out of an awful lot of... But the idea of extracting a single from an album rather than an album made of singles is quite a different matter. So it means that there are a lot of songs which are less extractable, more ancillary.
Well, before we hear some samples of your recordings of Lieber and Stoller's more contemporary work, let's listen to The Coasters doing one of the Lieber and Stoller tunes.
Oh, they're so wonderful.
Do you remember listening to the Coasters when they really had hits?
Oh,
yes, of course.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yakety Yak, Long Came Jones.
Oh, yes.
Little Egypt.
Little Egypt.
That
marvelous.
I just
oh, yes. They always had such perfect timing and so fast and so funny.
Well, let's listen to Yakety Yak. And this was at the period when Lieber and Stoller were writing a lot of tunes for for the Coasters. And they were pretty associated
He said,
with one another.
What did Jerry Lieber say? He said, we didn't write songs, we wrote records.
Huh, yeah. You want to explain what you think the difference is between
Well, they worked it out with the group, what they could do. I mean, maybe one of the guys was just jamming and he did a little riff and Jerry said, well, put it in, and then he'd write it down. But maybe it was like a collaborative effort. It wasn't, were, you know, this is our big number.
But it was always thought of in terms of theater. You know, Jerry was going to the Pasadena Playhouse when he was a kid in California. He was going to be an actor. And so he always thinks in terms of the theater. Today he still does. He's done a lot of producing and so forth. He's really a theater person.
Oh, God. In fact, he was the one that really helped me get I was having a terrible time with this one song that's on the Vaudeville album, Poor John. An awful time with it. I couldn't find it. It was coming out too heavy. It was too...
You know, and in essence, what he really said, it was a very simple thing. He says, this character can't know better.
Uh-huh.
You see, now that's an acting kind of direction.
Yeah.
You tell an actress, don't know, stop knowing, you know. And that's the kind of thing that an actor can tell another actor. Well, it's that kind of clarity he's got that kind of mind, Jerry has.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's listen to Lieber and Stoller's Yakety Yak. This is The Coasters.
Take out the papers and the trash. Or you don't get no spending cash. If you don't scrub that kitchen floor. Just finish cleaning up your room. Let's see that dust fly with that broom. Get all that garbage out of sight. Or you don't go out Friday night. Yakety-yak.
Don't go back.
You just put on your coat and hat and walk yourself to the laundromat. And when you finish doing that, bring in the dog and put out the cat.
Don't hold back.
you give me no dirty looks. Your father's hip, he knows what cooks. Just tell your hoodlum friend outside you ain't got time to take a ride. Yaggity yak!
Don't hold back.
Yaggity yak, yaggity yak.
Do you think that there's frequently a correlation between popularity and quality? I mean, sometimes there is and sometimes there is not.
Well, again, it's the question of what makes it for that particular moment, and some things are just very right for that second because somehow they pick up whatever it is that is in people's minds at that moment. And it's not going to make one iota of sense in 5 years or 10 months. But that will happen, too. And it's not a question of whether they're good or not. That just seems to be right what you need to hear right then.
Right. Or sometimes it's a particular group like the Andrews Sisters in World War II.
Yeah. Or, you know, you just reminded me, how about all that World War I stuff that nobody wants to hear? Unless you happen to be a war buff.
Some of those songs are great, though. Pack Up Your Troubles in Your Old Kit Bag.
That was a great song. Fabulous. Now, there are other ones that nobody ever wants to remember, which are probably great big hits in their days, which were all about liberty and the flag and God and country and making the world safe for democracy.
I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier.
Right. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And things like that, which had a sort of immediacy, which were very important for the time because they happened to pick a certain... That's a thing I think any art, and I think our basic mistake is to think that it makes no difference whether it's popular or serious. I mean, we're all very categorical. I think we're sort of merchanting ourselves. This is where this has been over here, this has been over here. There are certain things that have a certain immediate rightness because they happen to fit the geist of the time, and they aren't going to make much sense in a year or two. I suppose that means they're less good. I'm not certain of that. That just means they make sense for right then. That's okay. That's part of what we need as human beings. We need certain things that fit us at the second. Other things which we can go back to. I prefer the things I can go back to. That doesn't mean that the other thing isn't also important. And also, those immediate things have something to do with making up the things that are more permanent. So we needed all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and look at what happened with Joplin. It was wonderful in its day. Nothing could have been more popular. And then it went through a long period where people thought, oh, well, that came out of the whorehouses. That's low-class music. That's not really serious.
Ragtime, it's old-fashioned.
And it took how long? It took like 70 years for it to really get its proper place. But now it's found it. You know, Joplin would be, he'd be a king if he came back today. He was called the king of ragtime, but boy... You know,
went
he lost
a
it at the end.
Terrible time, and the health problems he had, you know, and everything else. He was a miserable guy.
Mm. We're going to get to a portion of Lieber and Stoller's work that is probably less familiar to our listeners than Yakety Yak, which we heard a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
The songs that you've done on the Lieber and Stoller record of yours are songs that could be described as cabaret songs.
I suppose they are cabaret, and I don't know exactly what they are. I mean, you have to remember, here are two guys who are still quite comfortable financially, who are working all the time. They're doing production on other people's albums and on theater, things like that. They're either here or they're in England all the time. They're very, very sought after, and they have this new brand new book that just came out, which is about the history of their time in rock and roll and all the things involved, and, you know, all the people who they've worked with will be mentioned, we're in it, I think, and so on. So the point is that they don't have to make a great big hit at this particular point, although it would be very nice. So these are things that they really did to please themselves. I first got to know them as songs after I got to know Jerry and Mike, which was in the early 60s. They were already sort of part of the whole New York art scene. Among the painters particularly. It's interesting that Jerry is now married to Barbara Rose, the art critic. And all the people that they knew always thought that these were wonderful people. When I first met them, you know, I was sort of amazed. You know, my gosh, I had, you know, been trained in Paris and on the West Coast and, you know, Lieber and Stoller, rock and roll, I mean, all the rest of it. But then I got to know them and I realized how good they really were. It was something that I didn't know how to handle my own liking of the material at that time. You see, it was the same darn hang-up that most classical musicians go through. But then I found out they were, first of all, very bright. They were obviously street tough people. They knew what they were doing at the same time. They were very conversant in all the arts. They were completely accepted as part of that whole circle, which included all the painters like Franz Kline, Larry Rivers, composers like Morton Feldman. And I mean, like, there was no problem. We all knew each other, which was, I thought, wonderful. That was a great time in New York because it was a time when all the arts were really quite close together. This is all probably more due to Frank O'Hara than anyone, because Frank was the kind of person who made sure we all kept up on each other's work. We all would go to somebody's opening. We all would go to somebody's poetry reading or somebody's concert. And so you'd have a concert. It wasn't just musicians out there. There were the painters there too, which was wonderful. And one time at a party when Jerry had a big apartment, or maybe it was Mike's, because they've moved several times since. This is a big apartment on Central Park West. And Jerry just got up, and Mike got at the piano. He has a wonderful sort of a three-fingered way of playing, very one note in the bass, sort of like Jimmy Yancey. And wonderfully clean playing, no note wrong, but no more notes than you need. It's wonderful. I just love the way he plays. And Jerry got up, and Jerry, by the way, is the best deliverer of a lot of his own songs. Nobody does Is That All There Is the way that Jerry does it. Jerry is still the best. He's got a certain absolute marvelous, that dry chuckle he gets in that last verse about the, I can't wait for that disappointment. Nobody can do that. He's got that terrific, but the big trouble is once they have to get up and do it in front of the audience, they both clutch. It's terrible. But there we were, and they did a bunch of these songs that I had never heard. I'd heard the stuff that they did for rock and roll, but they did some of their oddball songs. This is the late 60s. And I said, well, my golly, why won't you let people hear this? He said, oh, well, we do these for ourselves. And we just did it for our own fun. You know, I mean, not that we weren't serious about it. We didn't care about them. But we never thought that these would be anything on the hit circuit and so on. So eventually they thought they'd bring out an album. So they had Peggy Lee do some of them. And then there were other ones that she hadn't done. And just about that time, I had started to think, well, why don't I go and see Jerry and Mike and see what they've got? I have a sort of a mad feeling I would like to do a bunch of this stuff. So we started doing them in concert. They were delighted, of course. And out of this came the album. So it's not really necessarily cabaret. It's not necessarily this, not necessarily that. And what I wanted to prove was that we could make these things work without orchestrations or without a backup group. And the songs that we actually did on this album are things that will stand by themselves with just this very non-produced quality of 27 strings. You open the drawer and there they are, and you close it quick and they're gone. You know, it's a whole kind of different quality. And so they were very happy with what we did, and we've done them all over the place. Right now, the darn thing is taking off in England, I understand.
That's terrific.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's our 45 of two of the songs on there.
Humphrey Bogart and Black Denim Trousers.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear one of the songs. This is Tango. And John, can you tell us a little bit about this song before we hear it?
Jerry said they wrote this a few years ago.
When Ramon Navarro died.
Right, at that point. And it was curious because almost 2 years after it was written, there was that big story in the paper about that decorator who died, who had decorated some rooms for Jackie Kennedy. And he said it just stopped both of them because the situation was almost exactly what they had described,
like
with the thing around
art.
His neck and his feet tied. And and he said it was like they had seen it.
Art
know?
Collection. It was, you know.
Yeah, the butterflies and the black velvet. Yeah, and this guy had these fabulous things on the walls. And
so it's like a sort of incredible picture, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. It's a portrait of, you know, really accurate of certain kind of
life and certain kind of death.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is Lieber and Stoller's Tango, performed by Joan Morris and Bill Balcom.
With a thin black mustache, a wide scarlet sash, black boots and a whip. Oh, the tango is done with seafaring trash, reeling from hash, fresh off a ship. Oh, the tango is done. It's a dangerous dance, a treacherous step, and if one should trip, the frail body breaks with a snap and a twist, and a gold watch slips onto a thick tattooed wrist, and a gray merchant ship turns black in the sun as it heaves to the east when the tango is done. Butterflies mounted on fields of black velvet, neatly arranged in gleaming glass trays. Etruscans play follow the leader forever around the edge of a vase. The phonograph's playing an old broken record, a tango, and over and over it plays, over it plays, over it plays. A medieval tapestry hangs like a warning, a needlepoint forest of dark green and brown. The scene is the hunt, you will notice the hunter. He takes careful aim as your eye travels down and finally rests upon the real victim, lying quite still in a silk dressing gown, lying quite still at the edge of the carpet. Bright scarlet sash round the neck. He was a collector of beautiful strangers, and life was a party right up to the end. The door always open to love and love's dangers. Who did it? A lover, a stranger. Etruscans play follow the leader forever around the edge of a vase. The phonograph's playing an old broken record, a tango, and over it plays, over it plays, over it plays, over it plays.
Can hardly speak, and
I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Out together dancing cheek to cheek.
How did you decide to do an album of Irving Berlin songs?
Well, it was one of the things, I think that may have been Bob Kimball's idea. It probably was. Now, Bob has been an old sidekick and friend and cohort for many years. We did, of course, the book on Sissel and Blake together. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's called Reminiscing on...
Oh, I have seen that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Reminiscing with Sissel and Blake, which was the title of their act when they were in the middle of their own show, Shuffle Along, Noble Sissel and UB Blake, of course. And I'd known Bob before all this, and he was actually who generated the idea of me doing my solo piano Gershwin album many years ago, because that's not that many, it's just a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I think he may have actually thought of doing this one, too. Bob is quite close with the Berlin people and Irving Berlin himself, who, by the way, is quite happy with the album.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that.
Yes, uh-huh. He's called Bob twice. He's never called us. He's a very moody person. Some days he's up, some days he's not. Well, he's 91 years old. I think one can afford to be a little
Bob said he was difficult. Really happy with it, that he said it was a pleasure to hear him done right, you know. And, well, we, when we went into our producer after, oh, this was, I don't know, some months after These Charming People had been released, Tom Shepard produced it for RCA, he said, well, we want to do another record, you know, just two of you this time, and what do you think? And I mentioned Rodgers and Hart, because I want to do that eventually.
Yeah.
And he felt that had been...
done to death.
Yeah,
recently,
overdone.
There's been a lot of Rodgers and Hart albums.
So I think it was Bob Kimball mostly. He said, well, how about, you know...
Well, Bob had thought of doing it about 2 or 3 years before, too. And Tracy had said, well, I can't do Irving Berlin on my album.
Boy, it's funny how
and now, of course,
changed.
She feels
yeah.
differently. But at that time, she said, I can't see how I can put this on such. And I said, well, I guess we'll have to go somewhere else.
Oh, yeah, even when we did the first record with her, because what we were doing then was songs of the 20s and 30s. That's how we started out, the two of us. Our first concert was
all the
things
they were.
In fact,
it was her
idea to
do After the Ball. We'd never
done
that material before that.
Mm-hmm. We were getting to be known for doing the 20s and 30s. And she really wanted to do a record with us, but she said, this stuff is, it's pop material. She said, there's just no way, it's not PD, you know, there's just no way I can fit it on Nonesuch in the parameters of what, you know, what we have now. So
PD, of course, meaning public domain. That means you have to pay terrific
royalties,
yeah. You see. I mean, you don't have to pay royalties so much for Beethoven because he's not around to collect, but...
that was the problem.
Well, it costs
part
a
of the
lot.
Well, that wasn't the main thing. It was mainly that she felt it wouldn't fit on Nonesuch, but she used that to reinforce. She said, and look at this, I'd have to pay a fortune, and the budget won't handle that. You know, this is a classical label. It's much smaller than, you know, regular pop things. And she said, well... She said, but I do want to do something. She says, what about going back to the real classics of popular song? The ones that have survived, that we still do, that we still remember. She says, that I could see, because they are classics in a way of their type. So that's why we called it, a treasury of turn-of-the-century popular songs. But, oh, we started calling our programs the classic popular song because of that, too. And then it just kind of stretched a little. Well, the Lieber and Stoller, whoever would thought that would be on Nonesuch? You know, that's,
well,
I mean, maybe Schoenberg cabaret
rollers.
Songs you can
yeah.
see, but,
right.
you know.
But they just said hello to Tracy is what it came down to. That's how it
mm-hmm.
happened. She really runs it pretty much out of her taste. And that's, I think, a fine thing.
Mm-hmm.
It does mean that you have a point of view. It's not a committee point of view. It's somebody's
right,
point of view.
Right.
For good or ill, I don't always agree. But then, of course, you would never always agree with any one person. But at least it is a kind of personal label. And she has a very fine sense for those things, too.
Oh, and she never says, well, I want another mm-hmm. record. It's time to do another one. When you have a project and, you know, you really believe in it and you go to her with it and she sees it and if she likes it and if she sees that, you know, it's worth doing then. But it's not a case of, like, see, if we signed a contract or something with RCA or Columbia, we'd be then committed to do a certain number of records over a certain period of time. And we're really lucky we don't have to do that. Because I was just doing a show at the Guthrie this last winter, and that's why we won't do a record this spring, because I was very involved with that. I'm going to be doing another show there next season.
Mm-hmm.
And
we've done 8 records together in 4 years.
Yeah, that's a lot.
It's a lot of records. Yeah. I'd like to lay out a little bit.
For a while.
You know, I really think so. I like the way that touch. It wouldn't hurt.
Well, Irving Berlin has written, what, close to 1,000 songs. How did you decide?
800 published.
800 published.
And then some others.
How did you decide which ones you were going to do on your
album? There were a lot in same categories, for one thing. Some things he doesn't care for so much anymore. He doesn't want done. We tried to balance it between the ones that are well-known, that are really great, and others that aren't so often done and so well-known that are also great, that we felt deserved, you know, more attention, like Pack Up Your Sins and Go to the Devil, and Oh, How I Hate to Get Up in the Morning.
And The Girl on the Magazine Cover, I don't think that's very well known, and that's the one you named your record after.
It was, if you happen to see that movie that had Virginia Mayo or somebody in the 40s that had that in that, there was a big production number, I can't even remember, but I saw it. It was big in some 40s musical movie.
She was your heroine at one point, wasn't she?
Oh, no, the one I was in love with was Veronica Lake.
Oh,
boy, that dates
goodness.
Me, doesn't it? Yeah. Oh, I was crazy about it. And I saw her again in an old rerun. I said, I could never see what I saw. And I guess it was just a hair over one eye. But anyway.
The mystery.
That was, right. I don't know why I saw anything.
Well, I had a thing for Ronald Coleman, so.
Yeah. So let's hear The Girl on the Magazine Cover, which is the name of the album.
Terrific.
And the name of the song we're going to hear by Irving Berlin, performed by Joan Morris and Bill Balcom.
In a dizzy whirl, since I met a certain girl, there isn't another like her. She's a matchless pearl. Since I met this maid divine, I do nothing else but pine, because I know she never could be mine. The girl I love is on a magazine cover. It seems they painted her just for me. I'd fall in love if I could ever discover a little girl quite as nice. I'd fall in love if I